We'd like to open it up for questions. Carl has a mic, which we'd appreciate if you speak into, because we tape these programs and we make them available on our website to people around the world through Real Audio. So, and please let me indicate who the question is for, if not the whole panel.
Thank you. The question is for Timothy Brooks. You started it at that evening, roughly 9:30. From what reading I've done, and I certainly haven't done the reading you've done, in fact, the government had tried troops before that, but they were local troops, and that they had to bring in distant troops that didn't know the situation before they could be successful. Would you elaborate on this, if you know anything about it?
Yes. You've asked an extraordinarily complex question. Or the question was simple, but the answer is going to be a little complex. The government began to move the army. They began to move several of the group armies based on the North China Plain into the vicinity of Beijing in the second week after the democracy movement started. The movement started on April the 15th with the death of a former communist leader who was viewed sympathetically by students and intellectuals in the country. His death became a moment of memory and commemoration and political activism. The government began to move the two closest group armies into some kind of outlying position around the city without any particular plan of what they were going to do, but they wanted to just have troops on hand. They decided that this requires a little more history. Gorbachev was visiting China on May the 15th, 16th, 17th. This was the historic end to the Sino-Soviet split, or it was supposed to be, and it became a great press opportunity for the student leaders. The government decided that they would use military means, but they had to wait till Gorbachev left. It looked perhaps embarrassing to bring the soldiers in while another state leader is in town. He left on the 18th, and they brought the army in on the 19th. Now, this army was actually composed of units from many parts of China. It wasn't just a local army, but it was composed of units from many parts. They went in without the order to go ahead at any cost. They went in, by and large, without live ammunition. The idea was that you send the army in, a representative sampling of the entire army of the country comes in, and their moral authority is hopefully so popular, so high, that people will give way and they'll let the army come in and it will be a happy resolution. And that didn't work. The army was stalled for 3 days, and eventually the order went in for them to retreat. Now, when they retreated, they regrouped outside the city, but they then had the political command felt that they wanted a representative unit from every group army in the country. And there are roughly two dozen group armies around the country. So that the idea for the final suppression is that it's not going to be one army or even five or six armies, but it's going to be every army, if you like, is going to show solidarity, or if you like, is going to share the blood, if there's any blood to go around. The logic here is that you don't want a split in the army. You don't want one part of the army doing it, and then the rest of the army said, you're engaging in shenanigans that we don't approve of. Now, in fact, it appears that there were casualties from friendly fire, as it's called, during the suppression, when soldiers of one group army shot, by mistake, soldiers from another group army in the back. And there seems to have been a military face-off for a couple of days. It took the Chinese leadership a week before it would actually say anything about the massacre. And that was because there was a lot of political wheeling and dealing that had to go on. So, in a sense, your question is right in asking what are the sensitivities in the military to all of this. Of course, after it was all over, every soldier that you talked to said, "Well, I wasn't involved in it. My unit wasn't involved in it. It was somebody else." And everyone hustled very quickly to deny that they had been involved. My sense. Well, let me share with you a personal thing here. I was a student in China in the mid-70s, as was mentioned, and my roommate was in the People's Liberation Army. and we'd fallen out of touch. But when I was back in October of 1989 with the research for the book, after I left, he got in touch with me and gave me to indicate that there was great unhappiness within the military about what they'd done. Well, I think, if you like, the junior officer corps didn't like being used for this kind of thuggery in the streets. But there was a lot of division within the Army. And the way in which the government has handled that over the last 10 years is to increase the military budget, which they've done with great glee. And in one way, this sort of buys the military off. And in another way, it's also trying to keep the military... I mean, there's a kind of curious logic here that if you give the military lots of money, then they'll go away and they won't interfere in politics. And I think that's been some of the logic. I'm sorry, I've turned your simple question into a long answer, so I'll stop with that.
Any more questions?
Professor Brook. In this connection, which you just discussed, I remember something in a local paper within 2 months after the massacre that some 40 or 50 officers, Army officers, were shot for, I guess, not carrying out orders or for being in sympathy with the movement.
That's,
can you speak to that?
Yes, that's a rumor that I also heard, and in fact, some people, when I was visiting Beijing, some people claimed they could say where the executions were carried out. I have never found any reliable confirmation that that happened. It may have been wishful thinking on the part of the people of Beijing, who felt that the military had behaved so badly that somebody should have taken them out and shot them, or alternatively, that many of the soldiers and officers didn't want this duty, that they had refused to do it and they'd been shot for it. But it's nothing that I've ever been able to confirm from my own research.
This is a question addressed to anyone on the panel. Why was the loss of life so horrendous? Was it simply because the soldiers had no training in crowd control, or was there an attempt to make an example of the demonstrators and to attempt to stamp out the movement by the slaughter that actually occurred?
I just gave my version of the story. I think this is a very complicated, complicated issue. Basically, based on my understanding, why the soldiers are starting killing people, one big reason is, the citizens in Beijing are really trying to stop the soldiers. I think the soldiers, they got order from the high rank. Higher rank officials to enter the city without any necessary means. So there might be some confrontation between the Beijing citizens and the soldiers. Some of them may be hurt, some of them may be angry. I don't know. But when somebody starts shooting, I think they will not stop. So when you see the first blood, then they just continue doing it, because after they committed this crime, it doesn't matter how many people they shoot, one or two or 20 or even 100.
Yeah, and other reason, people said why the soldiers continue to open fire and also killed the people who, it's not necessary, they need to kill them. Social class conflict here. Most of the soldiers from the countryside, and they usually the the soldiers from the countryside, from the farms, they were poor. We know the social gap is really big in China. So that's why the soldiers, they before they enter the city, they already have some kind of anger. So when they has the order, also like Jun said, some other reasons, they open fire, and they just continue to do it and kill the innocent people.
Perhaps if I might also add, using semi-automatic weapons in an urban setting is usually a formula for high casualties, because it's different than on a battlefield. People are scattered. On hundreds of people massed on the street, you open fire into that group and you have very high casualties very quickly. So in part, it's the technology that was used. I don't think that the army was thinking about teaching anyone a lesson. They got desperate, and their political masters told them they had to solve this by morning, and so they ended up doing what they did. So I'm not sure that there's any sort of more ulterior kind of motive going on here. I think everyone, not just the students, but the soldiers and the government, were shocked by the casualties, and I tend to think that the numbers went into the low thousands and didn't remain in the hundreds.
One question I had, to follow up on that, Tim. The immediate killings in Beijing went up through what period of time, would you say?
The killings started on the night of June the 3rd, and that went on until about June the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
It continued to be sporadic shooting of civilians by soldiers who were just driving by in trucks, and they would open fire.
I have to also point out what I saw in Beijing. I think after the June 1st massacre, the soldiers themselves was frightened, and when I passed the Chang'an Street, when I tried to leave the Beijing city, I saw the soldiers. They grouped them together and back to back, try to watch everywhere to see if there's any suspicious person coming through, whatever. And whenever they saw something they don't like, they just go ahead shoot into that direction. So I still saw people like go up there and try to call their bad names, then they shoot them and try to those people that try to escape. So that's what happened. I think a lot of soldiers were frightened.
Even though of course the citizenry is totally unarmed in Beijing too. Go ahead.
What happened to the student that stood out in front of the tanks, and what was his name?
That, as I said earlier, there's just maybe Tim knows more about it, but I've heard that at this point nobody knows for sure. That.
The Amnesty International reported soon after the event that his name was Wang Weilin, and that he was not a student but somebody working in a business. But that was then later retracted, and no one seems to know. It's a great mystery, because the photograph that we saw today of the man standing in front of the tank is, of course, one of the memorable photographs of the 20th century, and the man has not yet been identified. I fear that he has that the Chinese government identified him and has removed him, and we may never know who it was.
For the student leaders, what policy do you think the United States government should be pursuing towards the Chinese government to promote the democratic reforms at this point? Is there much that the United States government should do, or would efforts likely to be clumsy and counterproductive? Do you think it's effective? What would be effective?
I think the United States government has a lot of influence on Chinese government, but they probably don't realize that. And I feel like the U.S. government right now try to sweeten the relationship with the Chinese government using a great excuse of engagement. Personally, I agree with engagement, but how can you engage with the Chinese government? Agree with everything they did? That's probably not the right engagement. I think U.S. government, if they really want to influence China, they have to have confidence in their in themselves. Not, you know, being directed by the business interest. And also, I think in the long term, a better China, democratic China, is good for U.S. business. And I think, you know, they should continue to pursue the human rights issues in China. And they should continue to say no to the Chinese government on whatever they did wrong.
Yeah, I think when the American government deal with the Chinese government, like the most important things are like the trade and the business. I think when they deal with the Chinese government, do they really weigh the value you believe or weigh that a little bit more or weigh the profit a little bit more? That's the, I think that probably is the key point.
One more question.
That'll not be the last question, or my question cannot be that that profound. But I'm an economist, and I really hope for the kind of solution that Gene is mentioning, that economics can bring about the eventual political change needed. My concern is that is talking with Chinese, young Chinese in China who share those very same hopes, but are believing that China, because of its very basic and long-standing culture, is going to be very slow to change. It's not even so much dislike of the Communist Party. As a matter of fact, they believe perhaps the Communist Party needs to be a part of the change, but the concern that it's so deeply embedded in the Chinese culture that many of the people already are blaming, really, the students and the people who brought about the 1989 demonstrations for having a great disruption, feeling to them more like previous years. So, the question is just how serious is that, and what is the likelihood for being able to bring about real change?
Well, I agree with you. The economic progress doesn't necessarily result political change in China, doesn't necessarily result a democratic China. I think it's only one part of the condition. I think the other most important part, as I mentioned in my speech, there are two major tasks we have to carry forward. One is continue support the opposition movement inside China. I think the opposition movement is a key factor, as I pointed, of the peaceful transformation of China, because opposition movement will bring in check and balance into China's political system. And they will continue to put pressure on the Chinese government to make changes. The other, as you pointed, is the cultural issue. I think the Chinese people doesn't have much idea about what is a real democracy, because I think a democracy is not necessarily a system. It's more likely a system of a system of values, what you believe in. Do you respect other people's opinion? Do you respect opposition, the existence of opposition? Do you tolerate different ideas? Do you believe in what other people do you believe in other people's right to speak differently? Do you believe in other people's human rights? So I think there's a lot of issues we have to solve here in the Chinese culture. So that's why I'm personally thinking that we should rebuild the culture of China to build in this modern values into the traditional Chinese culture. Then that way we probably can fundamentally resolve the problem.
We've really run over time. All right, one quick question.
Okay, this is for all of you. Sometimes the situation in China looks very hopeful. Sometimes it looks absolutely depressingly futile. And so I'm just curious to kind of end off here. As three experts on the subject, could you give us your expert forecasts on how long will it be before China finally achieves freedom and democracy?
Personally, I hope it comes soon as possible. But just a wish. I think to achieve the real democracy and freedom in China, it would take not only one generation, probably several generations. Long process we need to work. But I do believe probably have some changes. I mean, political changes in China several years later. Because I think the people's mind has always changed. Like Jin and I all both talk about the culture. Like in China, we say the Communist Party not only try to manage your kitchen for you, also they try to manage your bedroom for you. So, you know, the control is everywhere. They control every aspect of your life. So I think we do need accept besides the change, I mean, in the system, the political fields, we do need change in the culture and the traditions. That's a long way we need to we have to go.
I'm not a fortune teller, but I'm pretty optimistic about the changes in China. For example, just 10 years ago, you virtually see no opposition movement in China, as I mentioned. But now, you see the dissidents everywhere, not only in the United States, but also in China, like the Chinese Democracy Party, like Ding Zilin, like Li Hai, like many of them who've been put into jail. But after they come out, they continue fighting for democracy. They continue persistently fighting for democracy. So I think as long as we are persistent, we continue our effort, maybe for 5 years, maybe for 10 years, maybe for one generation, as Dan said, I think one day we will achieve. I think we just need to be patient, and we need to be persistent, and we need to continue work on it.
Well, as a historian, I get to predict the past rather than the future. And I think the only thing that I would just support what Jing has said. And what I would add is that we should be prepared to perhaps not to recognize democracy when it comes to China. Democracy is not any one thing. It is a set of standards, relationships, and ideas that are going to vary in every cultural setting. So that we shouldn't necessarily expect China to turn out the way the United States has, nor, however, can we use that to say, well, they do something we don't like, but it's Chinese, and so we won't worry about it. I mean, at some level, there are basic rights, I think, that have to be respected in all societies, the most basic being that you don't kill somebody. And once that right has been respected around the world, I think the world as a whole will be a far more democratic place.
I want to thank all of our speakers, in particular. I want to thank Professor Brook for his really pioneering work. It's a lot of work to do what he's done. And I want to thank our two Chinese leaders for the real heroism and commitment to principle that they've exhibited for years. A couple of things I also want to mention. In reference to the last question and also their comments, if democracy means dictatorship by the majority, that's not exactly what I think people are talking about. They're talking about democracy in the way Tocqueville talked about it in his book, Democracy in America, a system of civil institutions in which people have liberties and the ability to pursue their lives without the threat of indiscriminate violence and the secure in themselves and their property and their families and so forth. I do think that one of the things that China and any society like that is facing, which they cannot control, is the revolution of technology. And the technological revolution is making the ability to impose order by regimes more and more difficult with every passing day. So that is a tool that I think that we will see more and more evident as time passes. One other small thing before I'll just wrap up quickly is many people also don't know that the goddess of democracy and the Statue of Liberty and other symbols have a very interesting and ancient historical roots to essentially beacons from the ancient worlds. And these beacons were largely lighthouses. And so I'll just point that out since I'm standing in front of one. Professor Brook has really kindly indicated that he would be delighted to autograph copies of his book. If you have a copy, if you don't, you should get one. We do have posters of the famous tank lineup in front of the student. And if I could recommend, I would think that our two student leaders would be interested and persuadable to autograph copies if you're interested in getting copies. Yeah. It's actually, we get this from a firm in France that has the rights to it. The last thing I'll mention is we hope that you will be joining with us at future independent policy forums. And if you have any questions about our program, please let me know. Thank you so much for joining with us, and good night.